Well, would you open with me for a little while this evening to Esther chapter 3. Esther is a very well-told story, and it does mean that there is a need for the setting of the scene. A number of things that develop need to be put in place first if we are to understand how God, indeed God, is working, and if we are to understand the outcome of these events. And until this point, there are if you just take the events as they stand, they're a little bit strange, perhaps. At least they're strange gathered together. There was the great party that this great king Ahasuerus celebrated, and the consequences of it as he banished his queen. Then there was the discovery of a young woman with no background, and she comes to the highest place in the land as the queen, the favored queen of the king. And then there was also that short record that we have at the end of chapter 2 of her cousin having a part to play in revealing a plot to kill the king. And all of these are simply told us, set in place, and we need to then read on to see where all of this, how does it come together? Why are we being told these various parts? And if we do have a look at the dates that are involved here, we're looking within these 2 to 3 chapters, we're looking at 12 years of the reign of this king. And so there's clearly a lot of events that have been left out. Why these in here? And then we come to chapter 3, and it gets all the more remarkable. Once again, we have that opening phrase, after these things, or it came to pass. There was a period had gone by, and we come to another development in the story. Part of that, the background to this is contained at the end of chapter 2, where Mordecai seems to have been elevated to sit within the king's gate in verse 21 of chapter 2. So he's in a place of some responsibility by this point. But chapter 3 is, you might say, is a story of two men that all of a sudden becomes much, much bigger. Or are there hints behind it that there was something bigger going on anyway? Something boiling away under the surface? We'll just try and be quick as we go through this evening. And let's just look at the, I think, really two main parts to this chapter. There's the opening of how all of this came about, which we might describe as personal tensions, the two men that are key to this story, and then how this opens up into certain political maneuvers. It becomes a much bigger thing. It becomes a national thing. So first of all, to reflect a little, to just examine what we do have in front of us to get something of the detail right, and to be well founded for going on in the rest of the story as well. Personal tensions. We have two men who come into conflict, and one of them is introduced here in chapter 3, verse 1, a man called Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. And it tells us that he was set above all the princes who were with him. He's become something of a prime minister. It reminds me certainly of Joseph, and where Pharaoh said to him, I'll give you authority. There's only a few things that you will not have authority over, I'm the only one who is superior to you. That's what Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, said to Joseph. You've got something, the same thing here, with King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, who says that to Haman. Haman comes between him and everybody else. And it would seem therefore understandable that the king in verse 2 says that everyone was to bow and pay homage to Haman. Again, that's what happened with Joseph, that as he went through the land, that's what the people were expected to do to Joseph. So it seems like that's fairly standard, par for the course, that he should have that kind of recognition. But there is a problem, at least for one person. There's a problem for Mordecai. There's a little bit of a problem that's shared by the other king's servants who were within the king's gate. It's difficult to understand or interpret precisely what their spirit was. They do perhaps initially at least seem to be concerned for Haman, that he's bringing trouble on himself. Who knows, it might reflect on them as well. These are servants. Mordecai is one of them. Servants within the king's gate. It's a place where the king's authority would rule. You would expect these kinds of servants, people in this place, to obey the king's command. And it was the king's command. It wasn't Haman's own idea. It was from the king himself, the supreme authority of the land. But Mordecai chooses not to obey that command. Why? We don't know. We're not told. But not to have obeyed the command of such a powerful king, and a king that he has an interest in from the end of chapter 2, there must have been something quite serious behind it. Was it relating to Haman? Some have wondered. Haman is defined here as one of the Agagites, and we're not quite sure. There are two possible implications of this. One is that is taking you back to Agag, who was the king of the Amalekites, who Saul was supposed to kill and didn't, but Samuel did. The Amalekites were the worst of Israel's enemies. They were mortal enemies, and God had judgment written all over them because of the way that they assaulted Israel in the desert. Does this mean that Haman was one of their descendants? It's possible, but let me emphasize, we do not know. It's not clear. There is a reference to Agag in other records of the time, a people quite separate from the Amalekites. Was it an ancient animosity? Possibly, but we cannot be sure. Was it that Mordecai understood God's word to forbid to bow before men as idolatry? But yet Esther, his cousin, felt free to kneel before the king in chapter 8. But there wasn't a problem there. And they were not the only ones who were faced with this kind of question. But it might have been how Mordecai understood God's word. Yet we have no indication that this is what he was most concerned about. Was it Mordecai's pride? Was he just a proud man and refused to honor another man in this kind of way? Because the bowing and the homage would have been quite extreme in those days, but we can't be sure just what was behind this. And I say that, and I spend a little bit of time on that, because there are open questions. We need to be very careful, and again, as I've said before, that there are times that we go through a story like this and we will add in interpretations, but we do need to be very careful. What we do find, though, is that in some way this whole matter has been associated with Mordecai as a Jew. Mordecai in chapter 4, verse 4 rather, he has told his fellow servants that he was a Jew. Was that part of his explanation as to why he was not going to bow to this man, what it meant to be a Jew? It is possible. certainly and not certain. Whatever it was, his fellow servants were pleading with him, urging him to rethink, saying, don't be so intransigent, don't be so obstinate. And the result follows that Haman noticed. It was pointed out to him by these servants, that's why we're perhaps a bit ambivalent as to what their attitude was, that they initially perhaps seemed to be caring for Mordecai, but then they told tales out of school, so to speak, and mentioned it to Haman, to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, to put into the test, how is this going to work out when Haman notices? Haman, perhaps, caught Mordecai and the servants by surprise. He doesn't just deal with Mordecai. Verse 6 is quite an eloquent expression as to what is going on in Haman's mind. He disdained. He said, "No, I'm not going to deal with him. That's beneath me. I've got a better plan." He doesn't just respond to the individual. It seems like he's basically saying to himself, they're all the same. They all will be the same. Deal with one, there's still the rest of them. He's not going to just deal with this one man. He's discovered he's a Jew, so I'm going to deal with the people of Mordecai. Destroy all the Jews throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Look at the emphasis that these terms lay on it. Not just the individual, they're all the same. It does remind me of the times where, even in our own day, where perhaps there is someone who identifies themselves as a Christian and behaves badly. And it's the only thing that's needed for so many then to say, well, look at all these Christians, such hypocrites. Everyone labeled because of one. It's certainly what we found here with Haman and Mordecai. Two men, but it becomes so much bigger. I think the other striking aspect that I'm seeing here is that Haman was filled with wrath in verse 5. This was the king's command to bow and do homage to Haman. Why didn't Haman take it to the king? So here's a man disobedient. Well, a little later on he kind of does, but he chooses not to name the man. But he takes it as a personal affront, as the rest of the book also makes clearer. His personal rage. And so, because of the position he's in, he's able to implement the plans that come to his mind to deal with that. A number of folk who write about the book of Esther put it this way. They say that plot runs the book. There's not a lot expanding on individual character. But there are hints of character here. There is this way that Mordecai doesn't find any way around this particular command. There's the way that Haman bursts into wrath, a fiery anger. There are hints of the character, the pride of man. In these cases, is this a matter of poor personal management on both sides? Those kinds of things just blow over, but this one's not allowed to blow over. Here are two men who are in positions of significant influence, Haman obviously more than Mordecai. Are they ready for such roles? Yes, in that kind of society. Haman in particular. He was a very sharp operator, as we come to see in just a moment. But not in terms of character. His character doesn't stand up to scrutiny at all. We can bear that in mind also as we go along. We need to then move on to the second part of the chapter, where Haman comes up with his plan. He first of all he's decided that he wants to destroy the Jews in verse 6, and into verse 7 he casts lots. This is, nobody knows again exactly how it was done, but it was some way of looking for the omens to see what would be the most auspicious occasion to take action, this action he wants to do. And then from verse 8, how he goes about it. He shows why he is where he is. I wonder how often before this, to get to where he is, second only to the king, how often he'd spoken so cleverly, and he had also perhaps paid his way. He plays on the king's vanity. It's all about what pleases the king in verse 9, and that he's going to add to the king's riches in verse 11. And he plays the racial card. Doesn't have to name anybody. It's just this people. They're all over. They're knit into our society. But they're not keeping the king's laws. One man who disobeyed one of the king's commands expanded to them all, and they don't keep the king's laws, all of them. He plays the loyal servant card as well, where he offers to pay for the work, as he calls it, to be done. It's kind of gruesome. He calls it work. He labels it in such a way that it becomes a procedure. Do we hear that? Haven't we heard of that? Especially in the 20th and 21st centuries. The way that words are used to escape the moral consequences. Cover the costs to do the work in verse 9. What he offers in verse 9, 10,000 talents of silver, again, precisely how much it comes to, but it's certainly a massive sum. Wherever he gets it from, perhaps from the plundering of possessions that he's referred to. But it, again, plays on the king's view of himself, his vanity, it would seem. He doesn't make any further inquiries. He doesn't say, well, if you're prepared to pay so much, what's in it for you? Why are you so interested in this? He doesn't inquire of that at all. He says, well, in verse 11, it's often thought that what he's actually saying here is, it's your money. If you want to spend it like that, that's fine by me. The people are given to you. Well, you're second only to me. I could do what I want. If you do what you want. So casual. It's painful. You see how he's making this plot. He's working things out, a scheme that's unfolding. I was interested, I am very much interested in looking at Esther and thinking, well, what did the first readers make of this when they read it? The first readers of Esther would have known other parts of Scripture too, such as Proverbs. And they would be reminded by what Haman was doing here of such things as Proverbs chapter 6, a few verses there, where the preacher writes, these six things the Lord hates, yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, Haman looking on Mordecai, a lying tongue, we see it all over the place there. Hands that shed innocent blood. A heart that devises wicked plans. Feet that are swift in running to evil. A false witness who speaks lies. And one who sows discord among brethren. He's described in the end of verse 10 as the enemy of the Jews. He may have been predisposed to this, but even what he's done here shows him to be just such an enemy. Through the rest of the chapter, we have the description of the procedure, not the plot unfolding or being developed, but the procedure. The letters were organized and the decree was written. And the verse 12 is quite a long one because it elaborates. It says it covers everybody. All the officials and all the scripts and all the languages and all the people, all the provinces in verse 13. Why all this detail? Isn't he just writing about letters? Isn't it telling us that Haman is so thorough? He's leaving no stone unturned. He tells us that the letters tell us that the intention was, in verse 13, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women. Destroy, kill, annihilate, they're not necessarily talking about different aspects of the undertaking, but it's emphasis, it's piling on the words. And no one was to be left out. It was to all happen on one day, but if you look at the dates in the chapter, you find that there are about 11 months before the letters have gone out, before the event was to take place. It was time to prepare. Verse 14, that they should be ready for that day. There were no half measures here. It was so meticulously planned. Everybody was covered. You know, this thing that strikes me is it says all the provinces. That would include Judea and Jerusalem. They were a part of this empire. Every province. Shushan as well. Again, look how just a few words set the character of the scene. In verse 15, the decree was also proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel, the center of the empire. So the king and Haman sat down to drink. It meant nothing to them. This was a work. This was something that they could plan, an administrative process. They could sit down and drink. Whereas just outside the walls, in the city of Shushan, was agitated, perplexed, in confusion. Later, in chapter 9, and verses 12 and 15, it speaks about this same citadel or city of Shushan. The tables had been turned by that stage, but it tells us that within that city, there was a sum of 800 local people that were killed by the Jews in self-defense on that day and the day after. 800 locals. The Jews were told that they could act in self-defense. So at least 800 locals were coming at them, even after that change of plan. There were people in Shushan who also wanted to be rid of the Jews. But on the other hand, there were Jews within the citadel, a significant concentration at the scene. There was perplexity, there was disturbance, there was confusion, depending which position you were in. There were those who might have been against the Jews, there were those who were for them. The Jews had been in this place amongst the other provinces for 100 or so years. By this time, they were settled. They were quite possibly intermarried. It wasn't just the Jews who had been brought out from Jerusalem, but a wider connection. They had been assimilated into society. We were speaking about this afternoon in Eastern Europe in relatively recent times. There are so many similarities here to the horrible things that happened in Europe in the 20th century for the Jews. And just this intensity of the plan that everyone should be destroyed without exception. Perplexity. Hardly surprising. Why? Why now? I've attempted to highlight the drift of the story to this point. For this evening, I want to just wrap it up here for this chapter so far. That's not, certainly not the end of the story, as you well understand. But it is going towards setting the scene. It's leaving us with a question. What is going to happen in 11 months' time? The king and Haman have sat down to drink, expecting everything to go according to plan in 11 months' time. What happens in the meantime? Prior to this, there was this young woman of no known background, along with her cousin, who was brought into a place a little bit closer to the king. We know that they were Jews. The narrator tells us. Things are going along. It's fairly quiet. They're having to have a place in society. And suddenly, all the Jews are threatened with extinction. It's shocking. The first readers, should they have only come this far, it's a shocking tale to tell. And what are they to think? Anyone of the Jewish community throughout the provinces, if they remembered God, would they be asking, well, will God save us? Will God save, as they read, will God save them? Those who had a care for Judah and Jerusalem as God's chosen place, what will happen there? If there are no Jews left, what will happen to God's promise? As these things unfold, how can this be for good? God had promised often through the prophets, my thoughts are for you, are for good. Go and settle in that place. It is for good, it is for peace. How can this be for good? How can today's sufferings of God's people, for Christians around the world, how can that be for good? All things work together for the good of those who are called. However, I think that even more important than this, and for us also coming to Esther, perhaps even more to the point, is the question, who is asking those questions? We don't see it in Esther. Who asks? And we're not told. We're being asked the question. In all of these events and the drastic change that has taken place, for whatever it is that motivated Mordecai to bring him to this place, to bring him as the instrument for the Jews to be brought under this threat. In every one of these steps, who was looking to God for his light on affairs? These are his people. Were they under his lead? The story is not yet complete, but there are these questions that are laid in front of us, implied by just such a story as this. Where is God? But who is asking, where is God? That's in the first place. We've sung some psalms of the psalmist who did ask the question, where is God? Which was them expressing their faith. Faith was not gone. Is it here? Was it there at the time? And for all who would name Christ, take the name of Christ today, are we under his leading? Are we looking to him through every difficulty that we wrestle with? How, as the psalm put it, then came to mind, then to my heart there came this thought, on this I will rely, the years of the right hand of power of him who is most high. We can only go so far this evening, but let us seek God's blessing on his word among us.